This past Wednesday night when we, thank you, Carol, when we gathered, thank you, I shared there that it felt a little too hard to be speaking with you all from the pulpit, and that I needed to be a little bit closer. So, can you see me? What if I sit? Yeah? Robes are not meant to be sat in, but I needed to be closer. Many of you will know that back in the time of Jesus' life and early after his death, there were men, friends and followers of Jesus, who were called disciples or apostles. They were his students and, in turn, after his death, became the teachers in Jesus' absence, each having their own understanding of their beloved and his life and death. They took their practice of student, now teacher, very seriously. They traveled from community to community, and at times when travel was just too difficult or not quick enough, they preached by way of letter. Paul, one of the apostles, is most well known for this practice, and today has inspired me to preach as if I am writing a letter, an epistle, if I be so bold. Now, before I begin, I need to say a few things, and the first is that this was the title of the sermon, No Matter What Happened on Tuesday, a good lesson in accountability for me. And the second is that while I offer this letter today to the president-elect, this is really a letter to each of you. But what makes it hard for me is that it's actually a letter to our children. Dear Mr. President-elect, we do not know each other and likely will never meet, though you have visited the neighboring town in which I live, and based on the outcome of the election, I know many of my neighbors were there to greet you. By way of introduction, I want to tell you about one of the most beautiful parts of my life, the congregation I serve, the Unitarian Universalist Church at Washington Crossing. That's right, Washington Crossing. An historic and bucolic space where each Christmas morning a reenactment of George Washington crossing the Delaware is held right down the street. Years ago, I am told, a congregant's son and his friends dressed as Native Americans and surprised the reenactors with an unplanned attack on their voyage. We take history seriously in our parts, but we do also wonder about it. How else it might have been told, whose voices are missing. We wonder about the winners, the storytellers, the ones who get to shape the historical arc. And we also watch when it seems to repeat itself. Just the other day, at a school where so many of our youth attend, there were swastikas found in the boys' and girls' bathrooms, and also anti-gay slurs, and a note slipped into a Latina girl's backpack telling her to go back to Mexico. It is a spiritual practice to take seriously our history and our history making. I share this with you on the eve season of your inauguration before the title elect fades away and you do become a more solidified part of the history we will one day examine. Because the task before you is weightier than I could ever dream. To not only wonder about history and your place, our place in it, in the making of it, but to also hear and listen and act knowing so much of the division of our union now is because there are those who have felt looked over and missing from the narrative. Not a new sentiment in our country, but for this particular group. And also because there are lives who have, from their beginnings in this country or by way of their expression of love or because they worship in ways that have been scapegoated and demeaned, these lives have been forced to look on and dismissed from the narrative. I'm sure you agree, ours is such a young American history, it feels on so many days quite fragile. But back to the church I serve. Each Sunday, we call our children to the front of the sanctuary near the pulpit. It's a symbolic act of shared participation as much as it is a ritual of appreciation. These little bodies that grow with curiosity and then audacity. Affection, but then also protection as they age. They keep us grounded in what we all once were. And then just in their presence, just in their bravery to travel the long aisle from their caregivers to the pulpit, encourage us to live more than thought or word for their future. I've been thinking a lot about the little ones lately. Mr. President-elect, there is one child who in my 3 years hasn't missed a Sunday to run full force toward me and into my arms. No matter how much heavier she is these days, or taller, or too old, no matter if it is before church starts or 5 minutes in, her dive into her minister's arms takes my breath away some days. You see, you will appreciate as a leader and as someone who will represent much more than only your particular personhood, the mountain climb of progress in this moment of affection. A child uninhibitedly climbing the stairs to where the pulpit is, sacred ground and an intentional elevation from the people in so many other places. And there I sit, a lesbian, robed in clerics and with a stole that speaks to a recognized calling to lead the spirit and witness the lives of those I serve. Well, as I said, from the visual, I imagine you can appreciate how far we've come. For women and folks who aren't straight, for the children who embrace them and in turn learn they will, without condition, be embraced. There are other children here, too, of course. One child is a fierce, growing girl who promised to make me a dress about a month ago. With what on it? I asked. She looked at me, considered for quite some time. Lots of red sequins. Of course. After learning of when women could vote in religious education last week, it was her mom, not our curriculum, that had to reteach this lesson. For it was only white women who could vote then. Women like her mom, and like her one day, couldn't vote for another 40 years. You see, even in this intentional faith, there are still uncritical assumptions we make into declarations. I know you can appreciate the power in this. There is such power when we teach with confidence and forget our context. And I have to tell you, because I think we will share this moment, when I saw that correction had to be made, I was so embarrassed. And also so grateful. It's taken me many years to find appreciation in humility and the vulnerability of learning in public. My heart knows I don't do it well the majority of the time, if I'm being honest. It's good for all of us in leadership to have models in this work, you know. Next week, I'll dedicate and bless two children whose names represent the Buddhist teachings their parents cherish. And the week before last, I was reminded to include Diwali in the prayer so as to speak to another family's traditions. And it's not just the children, mind you, though it does always come back to them. We've got these teachers who, when a child can't sit still in class, they teach the lesson by walking laps with them and asking questions about our principles, about community, about relationships and the holy. We try so hard, not just to honor, but to create an environment in which every single one of us can feel whole. I realize now I haven't said this yet, but Unitarian Universalism is a direct response to the founding principles of our country. I suppose, in many ways, I shall look to you in the coming years to build with you this more perfect union. I worry about the children, though. Not any one of them for any one particular reason, but mostly because of baseball and pancakes and tired parents and nap schedules, and also how all the statistics say the culture of places like this, one of the most beautiful parts of my life, are in decline. This is the place in which we learn to be brave and kind. It's the place where imprinting happens, and we know there is somewhere in the world that will take us back again and again when we have felt lost. You should have seen this place on Wednesday night, singing together from the heart, lighting candles, and writing notes of gratitude on the wall. People wonder what Unitarian Universalists worship, but I didn't that night. It's as the Apostle Paul wrote, "You may have nothing, but you possess everything." All we had was colored pencils and used candles. We sang a cappella and had only a few lights on. And our most powerful tool was our breath. We didn't possess much, but this place held everything just as it always does. Like my colleague, the Reverend Robin Bartlett, has said of her congregation, imperfect people and untrained volunteers in some pretty old classrooms and state-of-the-art nothing. It holds you. And it holds these other beloved people who are your people, and it welcomes all. It brings a random assortment of interesting and different and tough and ragtag folks together so that we might learn to love one another better. It defines success with words like forgiveness and love and welcome, instead of with words like A+ or home run or perfect. Church takes patience and hard work, and it's boring sometimes, just like life. But it contains a group of people inside of it who seek to make themselves and the world better with kindness and stillness and strength, the kind of strength that requires softness and open-heartedness, not the hard body you get from lifting weights at the gym strength. And this kind of open-hearted, soft strength isn't always valued in very many places anymore, but it is the most important kind of strength there is. And it matters. It matters so much. We have nothing and possess everything. Mr. President-elect, I share with you in the safety of this letter that I am afraid. I am afraid that on some days my strength feels weak or of the wrong kind, that anger has taken the place of softness, and the success I value in forgiveness and love feels like more work than ever before. I want to be better for our children, for my child, who may one day walk into the bathroom and see his parents spoken of in those derogatory terms, or be reminded of his cousin's ancestry in the threat of a swastika, or who is simply wondering if kindness is the right kind of strength. I don't really know what to do about this right now, other than maybe be with my people in the ways that we worship. Be reminded of who and how I want to be and put all of my open heart into opening hearts, including my own. I hope that you will help me and help us. I pray that your own stories of history and hope of children and of wondering what to worship will guide us all into a shared future that is safe and open-hearted, forgiving and loving, and measuring in new and creatively compassionate ways the ways of success. We will likely never meet, but this letter has been good for me, and I hope for you as well. A friend of mine has started something called Neighborhood Love Notes, where you take a piece of sidewalk chalk and meditate about who you love rather than who you fear. It won't change the world, she tells me. There is so much work to do, but it can save a heart. So I put some sidewalk chalk at the back of the sanctuary, and I thought, maybe after we worship my people, the ones I serve, the ones who lift me by way of our shared intentions, grief, and collective hope, maybe we could worship some more outside of our sanctuary walls when the service is done. I hope you will find such simple things to call yourself back to a practice of love and connection these days. The responsibility of leading is an enormous one. May your people call you to the work of opening hearts like mine do. Mr. President-elect, I wish you could meet these people. For a century, they have worked and will continue to build the beloved community, no matter the task at hand. In faith, Reverend Kim Wildschewski. May all that is blessed be.